Hello, Tribe. Dr. Ken Berry here. Today, I've got a very rare treat for you. We're live inside of our private community today. And so if you're watching this on YouTube and you're not part of our community, that's why you're not able to ask questions. Nisha and I are going live inside of our group all the time. And every now and then we'll have an esteemed colleague join us. And so today I have the great honor and privilege of speaking again with Dr. Eric Westman, who is one of the OGs in ketogenic research. Welcome, Dr. Westman.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm really excited to do this with you. There, as you know, keto got really, really popular there a few years back, and that's kind of waned a bit in popular culture. And so for just the average person, they would think, well, I think keto, it was just a fad diet. It's kind of dying off. And you might think that until you go to a website called clinicaltrials.gov and you see how many active ketogenic diet research studies are ongoing right now. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about and let you tell everybody about. Last time I looked, and it's been a few months, there was over 100 active trials going on right now all around the world about a therapeutic ketogenic diet for either this condition, this disease, et cetera, and many more that are scheduled to begin soon that have already been registered at clinicaltrials.gov. So I want to tell you this. On Twitter the other day, somebody commented on one of my posts and they said, God, I wish keto would die already. And I replied somewhat pithily and sardonically, you know, it's like, well, sorry, I hate to burst your bubble, but keto's not going anywhere. Keto's actually becoming more and more firmly ensconced in nutrition science and medical science by the day. And so take it, Dr. Westman, tell us what projects are going on. Do you have any research projects scheduled or ongoing right now? What's the state of the research on a therapeutic ketogenic diet?
Yeah, thank you. And I agree with you that the low carb / keto / no junk food is hopefully here to stay. And the science has gone on for a long time. I mean, I got into it about 20 some years ago. And, back then I was worried about all the things that people who come to it for the first time now are worried about. So I'm like, relax. I was worried about that 20 years ago. Now I'm not. But the research that we did, I didn't create our method. I just studied it. And the low carb diet is, as we teach it, is 20 gram total grams per day or less, which is actually almost carnivore. I mean, when you look at the foods that we have, that we advise people to have, because we want to make sure people get into a fat burning state. So now, the research, I have followed Dom DiAgostino at University of South Florida for a while. And Dom is not an MD like us. He's not a physician, but he is a basic scientist. And he did a talk at low carb BOCA, a symposium for metabolic health. And I think he said there were 300 studies, if you include all of the basic science ones looking at keto diets now. And the big news in the clinical world for me is while we're seeing heart failure reversal in our clinic, and we talk about it anecdotally, there are no published papers. But now there is a Department of Defense funded study with Steve Finney and Jeff Volek as leaders or investigators, and I've known them for a long time. And it's really important for these studies to be funded and then done to get the attention, the credibility, the removal of disbelief, although that will probably never happen totally, So the clinical practice of low-carb, keto, carnivore is at least 20 years ahead of the science.
And absolutely. I want to kind of break this talk up into, keto truths, keto myths. And so you've already hit two keto truths. Number one is your ketogenic diet. If it's to be truly a therapeutic ketogenic diet, it needs to be under 20 total grams of carbohydrates a day. Now, keto product manufacturers love to talk about net carbs, don't they, doctor? And yeah, the danger with that is that a lot of the fiber that they use is actually soluble and actually can be broken down in your small intestine and converted into some degree of carbohydrates. And a good friend of mine, Kim Howerton, she once did 20 total or 20 net grams of carbs a day with keto products. And she was eating about 110 total grams of carbs a day, but it was still 20 net grams, right? So truth number one, 20 grams total carbs, not net carbs. And then the second thing you hinted at was that heart failure is being studied right now by the Department of Defense to be treated with a therapeutic ketogenic diet. Right. And that's because we now know, I think we've known this for years, but nobody ever talked about it. Cardiac muscle cells actually burn ketones more efficiently than they burn glucose. And so I predict within 10 years that it will be state-of-the-art medical practice that if you have somebody with any degree of heart failure, you're going to put them on a ketogenic diet immediately so that you can increase their ejection fraction and their cardiac efficiency. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I don't know timelines very well. It's always, you know, it's like every study is longer, it takes longer than you anticipate. And but I agree but even so, the heart, there's the heart muscle, and then there's the pipes, if you will, coronary arteries that supply the muscle. And then there's the electrical system. So and then there's the hormonal system. So there are really kind of four parts of the heart. So when someone says, you know, a diet's bad for the heart, I'm well, which part, right? So we know the muscle itself runs great. It's like a diesel engine on fatty acids and ketones. I mean, you want it there pumping, you know, just nonstop. The arteries themselves, of course, that's the coronary arteries. That's the quote, the diet's bad for the heart. People are actually talking about those pipes, the arteries. And I'm the hopeful that within that 15-year time, it'll be recognized that the low carb, keto, and carnivore type diets are actually healthy and does not promote coronary disease. But there's a prejudice and discrimination against high fat diets. And 20 years ago, I would say I would stutter because, you know, it was so wrong. You know, it'd be like, I'm not supposed to say, you know, a swear word, you know, or fat. But now, you know, so even, you know, recently there they are talking about, you know, there you go again, talking about LDLs when, anyway, there are still those kinds of preconceptions. And sure, it is really important to have the research started, yes, being done. And then, you know, don't get us wrong. When you start a study, you don't know the result yet. And that actually got the whole diet world in trouble because they started this low-fat diet thing, had a study with 48,000 women all around the country, and they taught it as if they knew the answer to the study.
Yep.
And then when the study was done, it didn't work.
I remember that very well.
But you trained this whole country, basically, of nutrition folks to think that low fat was better, but it was a study. And the results were... So anyway, we're very hopeful and optimistic that these studies will be positive. And in our pilot work, in our clinics, what we see is really all favorable. But, you know, it's important to have that follow-up science done for several reasons. One is there may be nuances to this. Maybe not everyone should do it.
Right.
And then to get the powers that be, the payers, the Medicare, the Aetna and other insurers to pay for things like, you know, having you see someone to tell you not eat carbs. Right now, that's not being paid for. You know, to get all of these things paid for, you need to have that kind of science done in a formal way. It's just, and you know, we want that for drugs because drugs carry harm, potentially.
Right.
And it's kind of sad that we need that level for what, you know, you and I know is kind of what people have always eaten for a long, long time, but and there's no harm to taking sugar and starch out of the diet unless someone's on medicine that makes things too strong. So, but it's my current research program is basically me doing anecdotes and reviewing papers. I wrote a chapter in a book that's coming out on ketogenic diet out of Professor Tim Noakes and the Noakes Foundation and Nutrition Network out of South Africa. They've been working on this for a couple of years now. It's going to be a great textbook of nutrition, and this will be the second major textbook. And you know, all of these dominoes have fallen so far that I changed the name of our clinic at Duke to the Duke Keto Medicine Clinic, because biologically and metabolically, this is very different, and it's a medically powerful sort of tool, not only for reversing things, but for preventing problems. So, and you know, being the old professor that I am, I guess the chief and department chair, who are now, you know, I don't know how many years younger than I am, they didn't give me any grief about changing the clinic name. So I do run the Duke Keto Medicine Clinic now. And when people come in asking for, well, what about these new drugs? I kind of go, did you see the name of the clinic? I'll refer you to my friends. But now, you know, that said, I don't know if I could create an academic clinic called the Carnivore Clinic. You know, I'm trying to find a academic metabolic place. And while endocrinology thinks they own obesity, you know, they don't have practical answers until now. These drugs are coming out that are, you know, actually have me a little worried, because they're so strong. And if you don't know the kind of boundaries of, you know, yeah, people should eat every day, you know, something healthy, or you know, don't go a week without eating. And that's what some of these medicines do. And some doctors are so naive. They think, well, oh, great, you lost 20 pounds in a week. Fantastic. No. That's not the healthiest way to do it. So, but that's my research really was the beginning of opening up this area, going back to the year 2002. And then we published papers up until, well, we started doing review papers, and I've actually become that doctor that you're supposed to be aware of or wary of, that they don't collect much new data anymore. They just do review articles, but there are other people collecting new data. It's not like I'm not paying attention. And I'm now in a position where I'm reviewing other articles, part of the peer review process, to give articles a fair shake. You know, there's one that I can't tell you what it is yet, but it should come out soon, where the alternate reviewer said reject it because, you know, because it's not possible. And so I had to come in and explain to the reviewer, the editors, basically, on how actually this is possible, given the new paper that David Ludwig, the carbohydrate insulin model. I'm an author on that one. We'll see. I just give my opinion and the editors vote yay or nay, whether it gets published. But you know, I'm in the clinic 4 days a week, and I have just one day for this sort of activity during daytime weekday hours. But you know, it's certainly, like you, this is a mission, a way that people, so many people can benefit from this. That and if you got into this doctor thing because you wanted to help people, I mean, it is just so reinforcing and so wonderful to see it help so many people.
Absolutely. And I remember the first low-carb cruise I went on. You were there, and I asked the question, and I've made it a habit to ask this question every time I speak in front of a group of people about a proper human diet. I asked how many, you know, healthcare providers are in the audience. And there was just a few, mainly speakers. There weren't many healthcare providers in the audience. And now when I asked that question, I was recently at Low Carb Denver. And Dr. Westman, it was bordering on half the room were either MDs, DOs, PAs, NPs, RNs, LPNs, pharmacists, dentists, physical therapists, PTAs. I mean, I met so many healthcare providers at one level or another at Low Carb Denver. And that to me is very, very reassuring that more and more healthcare providers are seeing the writing on the wall. It's really, it's hard to see it. It's hard to not see it after you've had your 20th or your 50th patient come in who you haven't seen for a year. And you're like, holy crap, Fred, you look great. What did you do? Keto. Well, the first time Fred says that, you're like, oh, Fred's always been kind of weird anyway. But then after you've seen the 50th Fred in a row, one of the powers of being in primary care, as you know, is to be able to see anecdotes firsthand. And if you see one or two, you're like, no, that's weird. I'll keep my finger on that pulse. That's probably just complete coincidence. But after you see 50 anecdotes, 100 anecdotes, at some point you're like, is this a trend or is this really just an ungodly astronomical coincidence? And I think that healthcare providers, especially in the primary care trenches, they see this, they see that. And after so many anecdotes, they're like, okay, let me look into the research on this. And thanks to you and Finney and Volek and so many other people, we have this body of research. And I've heard it said before, and I think it's true, that the low-carb ketogenic diet way of eating is the most researched way of eating on the planet. And for many plant-based doctors, usually cardiologists, right, and endocrinologists, they're not aware of this research. And so when Fred goes to see the endocrinologist and he says, yeah, I lost 100 pounds on keto and my A1C used to be 13, now it's 5.2, they think Fred's crazy. And then when they hear one of my videos, they think, well, that redneck's crazy. And then when they hear one of your videos, they're like, well, he seems like a scholar and a gentleman, but I think he must be crazy. And so it's really hard to move Overton's window for healthcare providers because they've got these huge powers that be in the AMA and the AHA and the ADA who they're not interested in talking about this, at least in the mainstream media. It might be on page 232 of their latest updated manual, but they're not going to talk about this in a press release, right? And so did you have, Marcia says, did you have any kickback or any friction changing the name of your clinic at Duke University in North Carolina to changing the name to basically the Keto Clinic?
No, because, you know, I played the politics within my organization, meaning I am in a building with my peers. I'm in the Division of General Internal Medicine, which is in the Department of Medicine at Duke University. And it's really important to, you know, for a couple of years, I'd brag about a patient. I'd go down the hall and, you know, and show the other doctors and they're, oh, okay. You know, so I did that to them through the years. And actually several of them are, you know, quite familiar with using it in their practice. But that's really important for even if you're in private practice on your own. I'm sure when you had other doctors, you would send a report back. I don't have the staff to send a letter saying, oh, look, your patient, thank you so much for the referral. I remember that. The old days, the doctors would dictate these letters, and yeah, I'm afraid I don't have those resources. But I did the politics of making sure my division and then my department was aware of the good things that were happening, and then financially, I play the politics of the financial politics of cozying up to the surgeons, so the orthopedic surgery. The heart transplant surgery folks, not weight loss surgery. We're still kind of philosophically on different planets, but if I can send people to operations that couldn't be done before, including heart transplants, then that makes money for the system. And yeah, so I've done that consciously, knowing that I have to get the bills paid, but I don't have a practice of my own to have to worry about that. I'm within the university private practice. And so I got no pushback. And even still, you know, for several years, it's been named that. And We'll see. I mean, the leadership is kind of defined by the second clinic that's named the Keto Medicine Clinic. If I'm the only one for decades, then I mean, I'm out on a limb and I didn't really lead anybody. But there are so many other practitioners doing this. And Gary Taubes even wrote a book called The Case for Keto. And in there, he chronicles all the, at least 100 practitioners who are using this. So it's actually helped to change the name because I get that recognition if someone wants to do it. And then, yeah, I'm getting a little tired of trying to figure out how to get the latest medicine and all this. I mean, and it's too harsh. And so I'm offloading that to other people and want to focus on people who have selected to just change the food, to change the health, because it's so powerful. And then I do like kind of pushing the limit on what things can be fixed, those anecdotes, getting 4 or 5 anecdotes together into a paper and then having other people read it. And that's worked in several areas that I hadn't anticipated. This McArdle disease, glycogen storage disease, is fixed by running the muscle on fat rather than holding it back on the fat. The type 1 diabetes, surveying the group of people following a Facebook group, surveying this group. So it's actually kind of a grassroots learning model here. We're learning from people in the trenches, but we want to influence the people in charge of grants and grant funding. The way it works is that you have to convince a group of reviewers in order to get a grant funded.
So let's say I'm a young PhD researcher at Harvard, and I've watched a couple of this crazy Dr. Berry's videos and a couple of videos by Dr. Westman. And I'm like, man, that seems really like a powerful intervention. I'm going to do a research study on a ketogenic diet for fatty liver, let's say. I want to research this. And so I take this to my department chair. Talk us through the politics that would be involved in that and all the different ways that that idea could be snuffed out without ever seeing the light of day. Because most people think, no, you know, common sense people like me, they're like, no, if something works, then everybody's going to be interested in that. Just by definition, if it worked in 100 people, why would we not immediately do a study to see if it really truly has a provable therapeutic benefit? Talk to us about the behind the scenes politics. You mentioned you had to, you kind of play some politics with the surgeons and with other people. People don't understand that kind of stuff goes on. They think, no, people just gossip and there's politics at the barber shop or at the truck stop.
No.
Take us behind the curtain, doctor, and tell us about the politics that would snuff that study and the politics that you've encountered personally over the last 2 decades that you've been researching a ketogenic diet.
Well, it's not perhaps a coincidence you mentioned fatty liver, because I have direct personal experience. Our paper on fatty liver being reversed with a low-carb keto diet, almost carnivore, or carnivore-like, should I say, is published 14 years ago. And so we took this paper before it was published to our powers that be. In fact, one of the professors is still here at Duke, 15 years later. And they said, that's fine. But the grants they write, they want to study people with fatty liver and then find out what the mechanism is so they can create a drug for it. So they weren't interested in fixing it with a diet. So even though the mechanism of fixing it might be figured out by studying people on a low-carb diet whose fatty liver is getting fixed, no, they would rather go and look into the cell to say, well, it's this enzyme problem, and if we give this treatment, we can write a patent and then a company gets money. So that's one problem, is that not all science is done to actually help the person in front of me. It's done to figure out a mechanism, find out a drug. Funny you mentioned Harvard, because I would say go talk to David Ludwig, who's in the pediatric group there. So now they're like people. I mean, it's sad to have to say it, but they're really like they're allies. Mm-hmm. It's not like this is a war or a board game of allies and we're against it. But on the other hand, it is kind of like that because they won't give you the dismissive, oh, well, you're crazy. So there are now, David Ludwig at Harvard with his group. It's got but it's pediatrics. So if you want to do it in adults, there's an artificial separation that you'd have to talk to the adult internal medicine people. But now at Low Carb Denver, by the way, your talk was fantastic. I thought it was a great meeting, especially for your viewers. Many of them were there. As you said, anyone in the tribe, raise your hand, or you had to stand up or raise their hand. It was great to see. And I hope if you were there that you enjoyed the meeting too.
Absolutely. And somebody asked earlier, can doctors get continuing medical education credits for keto, low carb, even carnivore conferences? And I got, I think, 22 hours of CME at Low Carb Denver. Now, not every keto conference offers CME. There's obviously a bunch of hoops to jump through in order to get accredited by the AAFP or the internist or whoever you're trying to get accredited with for CME or CEUs. But yes, Low Carb Denver offered about 20, 25 credit hours. And then the Society for Metabolic Health Practitioners, they also have CME that healthcare providers can earn by taking little courses or by going to their meetings. And so, more and more these meetings are being approved for continuing medical education for all levels of practice of medicine and healthcare. I heard a guy once say that in academic medicine and academic nutrition, it's publish or perish, and patent or remain a pauper. And so you hinted at that earlier, that literally every study, because even universities like Harvard, who have billion-dollar endowments, they only have so much money they can spend a year on research. And if a research study is going to cost a lot of money, and there's absolutely not going to be a patentable pill or a patentable injection or a patentable infusion or a patentable surgical instrument come from that study, and then they've got this other study that's going to cost the same, but there's potentially a billion-dollar drug that could be patented on the other side of that, guess what? Right?
Yeah. Well, of course, there are ways to get other studies done, but it's less favored. And at a place like Duke, the NIH grants are the ones that are most coveted because they just have other perks that come with it and the esteem from it. But at Low Carb Denver, I learned of a group, or was reminded of the group at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. They have a nice group of NIH-funded researchers now. And Amy Goss, who gave a talk on Sunday, is studying childhood fatty liver. So,
is now becoming an epidemic.
That in childhood type 2 diabetes, I mean, this didn't exist when we were in training.
Right.
And the idea that you would get fatty liver and then get cirrhosis or liver failure. So I've had the awkward situation of someone who had a liver transplant already, now having fatty liver, eating carbs.
Sure.
And the transplant was done because of fatty liver. So even the transplant program that put in the new liver didn't understand that it was basically carbs that was causing the fatty liver.
Sure. And I'm sure they warned that patient, you can't ever drink a drop of alcohol. Never take acetaminophen, right? Never drink acetone.
Probably reduce fat in the food because
there's fat. And then eat low fat, lots of fruit smoothies, 100%. Yes. Yeah. So they literally were destroying the liver they had just transplanted with the dietary advice they gave the patient at discharge.
So that student or the one who wants to do a project, I try to steer them either to the pediatric group at Harvard, University of Alabama, Birmingham, Ohio State University, where Jeff Volek is, University of Michigan, where Laura Saslow is, Tulane, Lydia Bazzano, so and Will Yancey here at Duke has a small research group going. But it's so, you know, it's like these little seeds are growing. It's just incredibly slow.
Yeah. And I think part of the incongruity that people feel is that we all know how quickly something can become a worldwide fad. That can happen overnight almost, right? But how do you change the practice of medicine? Well, it takes these studies. It takes first case reports, then case series, and then some mechanistic studies, and then a larger, more controlled study or two. It takes 2 decades, right? And many people have alleged that the only way to change medical practice is when all the old gray-haired men die and younger people take their positions, right? But I decided very early on, and you know we've talked about this multiple times, I'm not going to wait 20 years. I'm going to get this word out there now, because it's not like I'm promoting some weird pharmaceutical drug. I'm literally promoting meat and veg, which humans have eaten for 3.5 million years. It's not like I'm promoting some radioactive infusion. I'm literally saying eat beef, and it's okay to eat butter, and it's okay to have some low carb vegetables and a few nuts and a few berries. That's keto. Keto is meat and veg. That's what keto is. And but it got so popular so quickly, well, you know, that it sounds Spanish.
If you had a $10 million grant, you could give people radioactivity and instrument catheters in them and do all these things, because of the risk. It's as if the universities want money. Well, they want the money from the research to defray costs and risks and feed mouths. But you're right. So when we're talking about nutrition, the medical world really doesn't understand it. So it's been handed over to non-medical nutrition and dietetic experts, many of whom never had clinical practice experience, never had people come to them asking for drugs to lose weight. One of the PhDs who did a study on a low-carb diet came up and gave a presentation and said, well, there's a strange thing that happens when people cut carbs out. They're not interested in food and they eat less. And it's number 10 on the disinterest scale. And she said, this is not a good thing. And I said, Diane Stadler was her name. Diane, people come to me for pills to have this kind of effect. What do you mean? That's a fantastic thing. So it's like they're seeing the same thing and then describing it as terrible, or you know, it doesn't follow the guidelines. These guidelines are not like the tablets from Moses that say, you know, that God says you have to have bread. I mean, you know, they're all man-made guidelines. And so, because this is really risk-free, I mean, unless you're on medicine, you got to be careful, because you got to make sure you don't have side effects from medicines as you get off them. But we really, in this world of nutrition, don't need those kinds of trials to determine the safety of it. Although the perception is we need them.
Right.
Because, oh my God, you're telling people to eat fat. And we know how bad
meat
that
and veg. Is. What kind of person are you? You're telling people to eat meat and veg. I don't understand. That sounds very dangerous and very unusual. Now, we're live right now. Go ahead.
That was sarcasm.
That was a little sarcasm. Yes. Yeah, okay. We're live right now in our private group. We have 5,000 members in this group. And I want to tell the tribe members, now's the time. If you have a specific question for Dr. Westman, you can even ask me a question, but he's the man of the hour. Ask him your questions. I want to answer as many tribe questions as we can get to today, if that's okay with you, doctor. And then absolutely, if a question brings up a point, feel free to riff on it. And then if anybody's watching this on YouTube and you'd like to be part of this kind of private live Q&A with some of the leading researchers and leading thought leaders in the world of nutrition, low-carb diets, keto diets, ketovore, carnivore, proper human diets, you might want to consider joining our community. The web address is in the chyron that's scrolling on the screen below. So now's your time, tribe members. If you have questions for Dr. Westman, type them and be succinct and pithy but not laconic in your question answer. We need relevant information, but no superfluous information, so that we can answer as many as we possibly can. Let's talk about a few keto myths. What are the most common things that you see on the internet, you hear at conferences, you hear some of your colleagues, when you guys are getting together for morning rounds and they're like, well, I heard keto does this or that. What are some of just the very common myths that there's just not a grain of truth to, that's just complete foolishness?
Well, it causes ketoacidosis. So the inability to know there's a difference between ketosis and ketoacidosis. In fact, I hadn't seen ketoacidosis in my patients until these drugs came out where you leak glucose into the urine, and these drugs actually give the risk of the ketoacidosis, not the diet. And I know that it's going to be bad for the heart because the LDL goes up. That I still get. Right. There are people following the guidelines of you. If there's an LDL of this, you got to put on a pill. So I advise people to, just say you're using lifestyle to treat the cholesterol, and it's called metabolic syndrome, the triglyceride and HDL. And then as kind of a joke, I'll just say, tell your doctor you're doing the Mediterranean diet.
Right. Yeah. Whole food, low carb, Mediterranean. I think that's a great way to put it, because you said the key word, Mediterranean, which will meet with immediate approval by the doctor.
Yeah. It's almost like, made in America, must be great, more nuance to that. But then there are a lot of myths or misunderstandings on how to implement it with the advent of all these keto products that aren't keto.
Yep.
Keto is a metabolic state that you achieve by keeping the carbs really low. And it really hasn't, to the point of the detractors or critics, there hasn't been a study that I'm aware of 100 people on bulletproof coffee for weight loss for 6 months. All these things came out without really being vetted and tested. And it can get you into rabbit holes of, I have stomach upset because I'm drinking medium chain triglyceride, which I never recommended. So how you do it, there's a lot of misconceptions. And yep. I think you and I both kind of have a similar approach where you don't want to have all of these keto-like products out there.
Absolutely.
The sugar alcohols and all that. And bears don't, they don't even drink coffee, do they?
They don't. I tell people all the time, if it says keto on the package, 100% avoid it. That's not keto. Now, it may be less bad. So if you're about to eat some keto cereal, first of all, that ain't keto, okay? Because my definition of keto is unprocessed whole foods, one ingredient foods that we would have had access to thousands of years ago. And there weren't no cereal before we started building factories, right? And so there is no such thing as keto cereal. That's an oxymoron. And but it may be less bad than Lucky Charms. Yes, that may be absolutely true, but that don't make it good. Right. Mary's got a question, and I love that she asked you this question, because I know you and I, our recommendations on this differ a little, which is totally fine. Please talk about omega-6 to omega-3 ratios and the dangers, if any, of seed oils, any studies showing problems, etc. Thank you.
Yeah, well, so we have a different approach because as an academic at a university, I have to have high level papers to support my position, or maybe I just feel like I have to. I'm straddling one leg in the academic world. Show me the paper, show me the data, and one leg in the, oh my gosh, so many things get better and there aren't studies to say that yet, but I see it and we're studying it, and if it's not harmful, why not continue it? So the whole idea of the seed oils, omega-3, omega-6 ratio, best I can tell, it goes way back to the zone diet. And actually, Steve Finney talks about this a lot. And, Finney is like when E.F. Hutton says, I trust him implicitly, except he's a little too smart. I need some, human level, totally intact human research to back up, if at all possible, something to ask my patients to do that's difficult. So I know keto kind of came out with this whole glomming on of the macros and the avoiding seed oils and keeping the carbs low, and then the keto drinks and all keto, it all kind of just went out there all at once. Now disentangling, in fact, I met What's her name? She wrote Deep Nutrition.
Kate Shanahan.
Kate Shanahan, yeah. I saw her at a meeting. Saw her at a meeting, and we were chatting, and I asked her a question about this, and she was so into this that really she didn't understand what low carb was, and so when I even asked, well, and you know, maybe it was a bad day, I don't know, but sometimes you only have a moment with people, and I try to figure out where they're coming from, but if you just change the seed oils and omega-3, omega-6, people would not lose weight.
I agree.
And I told her, well, so you're saying that if people had a low-carb diet without regard to seed oils, let them have them, they would do worse than those who had seed oil. And she said, yeah. And I don't think so. So the street cred, like you and I have, and it's really important to follow someone who's been in the clinic to see the different ways this plays out and to find the individualization and personalization that sometimes, you know, we can't figure out or deal with over the internet. I mean, people will come in, I'm doing some internet teaching now, and they come to my clinic because they find, but they forgot to tell me, you know, X, Y, Z that were critical elements, you know. So anyway, the omega-3, omega-6, I think is a minor thing compared to carb reduction. Yeah. Now, if you were trying to find the perfect diet on earth, like you're trying to do,
right?
You know, you might take that and say, well, you want to be aware of that and do the. So I'm trying to grab people and get them out of the river, you know, and you're trying to, they're out of the river and you're brushing them off, dressing them up. I don't know the right metaphor, but it's more important to cut the carbs down really low.
Yeah.
And to obsess about you have to make your own salad dressing and you have to be worried about all these things. So, but if you can do all that, I'm not against it, but I don't have a paper. Tell me if you see one where we're real people, real humans, we're assessed some way or ideally randomized to worrying about their omega-3, omega-6 or not worrying about it. Ideally, if it was under low carb circumstances, Because that's where you and I are. We're trying. How do we augment what we already know is so beneficial? And so I don't tell my people to obsess about worrying about seed oils and vegetable oils, if that's going to distract them from the greater important message of keeping carbs low.
No, and I agree. When it comes to weight loss and reversing fatty liver and reversing type 2 diabetes and lowering hypertension, it's all about cutting the hell out of the carbohydrates. Now, the only papers I've seen that there are some people out there who are fairly influential and fairly intelligent, who like Kate Shanahan, who I love her. I met her recently, and she is amazing. And she's writing a book right now about the seed oil problem. I don't know of a single, as you say, whole human study that's not a in vitro or some kind of, you know, isolated in vivo mechanistic thing. But absolutely, my first three tenets when I started doing what I do back in 2017 were stop all sugar. Definitely added sugar, but also a lot of natural sugar as well. Step two, eliminate all the grains. And I think that that's the first two steps right there. And if you do those two things, you're going to slash the carb intake by 70, 80, 90%, right? But then step three is get rid of all the vegetable seed oils, because I've seen some mechanistic papers that make me think that they probably do contribute, if you're eating too high of a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, that they do contribute to some chronic inappropriate inflammation. And you know, we know that chronic inflammation can lead to things like heart attacks and strokes, if depending on where the inflammation is. But I agree with you. There's no human papers written in actual whole human beings showing that if you give them canola versus beef tallow, that their levels of inflammation are going to be higher.
But in the approaches we teach, you're not going to get much of that anyway.
Right.
So as long as these are things that are typically found in products and you know, and ultra processed stuff that you're going to be minimizing by the proper human diet or a low carb keto. Which these are like kissing cousins. I mean, I don't know how to say it, but they're both super low in carbs. And you know, I if you're able to go the extra mile to and then in get certain circumstances, if say someone has an inflammatory disease and we haven't been able to fix it, then I might add that in. So it's kind of like, I remember we were in the same audiences a few times, and I would say, you know, how many of you had trouble with nuts at the beginning, over consuming them, and, you know, boom, all, you know, half, I figured it was 50%. And then I'd say, how many of you had trouble with artificial sweeteners at first, you know, and, you know, there's a trickle here and there. And I think if you're in a relationship trying to fix a tough medical problem, what's the downside?
Exactly. I totally agree. And so the big thing for me about the vegetable seed oils, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, is that we've only been eating this high of an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio for just a few decades. Before the advent of cottonseed oil about 1910, the average person in the world was eating approximately 4 to 1 omega-6 to omega-3. And then if you go back even further in time, a few thousand years, it was probably pretty close to 1 to 1 omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids, according to the anthropological research. But obviously that's kind of indirect, right? Because you don't have a time machine. You can't go back and actually measure. But there are people that get so hung up on the omega-6 to omega-3 thing that they'll recommend people to avoid pork altogether and avoid chicken altogether because they don't have as low of an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. And I think when you start doing that sort of thing, you're trying to establish some kind of religion, or you know what I'm saying? Like you can't say, oh, you can eat this meat, but not that meat. No, either meat's good for humans or meat's not good for humans.
Yeah. So to put it together, I think that's a relatively minor thing. You know, if you want to incorporate that in, sure. I don't see a downside to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Jillian says, I've only lost 26 pounds on ketovore since June of 22. First of all, Jillian, congratulations for losing 26 pounds. Good job. So for 9 months, got fasting insulin today and it's 22. My A1C is 5.0, glucose 98. He didn't do a C-peptide, which is fine because you got your fasting insulin and you're not injecting insulin. So fasting insulin is that's exactly what we needed to know. Is this why I'm losing so slow? Any tips?
Yeah, so a couple of things I'd like to know is where you are in the weight loss journey. You know, are you at, it sounds like you're still on your way, or, you know, so yeah, insulin, although the couple of studies that were done seeing if low carb diets led to greater weight loss, if you're insulin resistant or not, were done in the hands of the Stanford group, which really, they don't give low carb a fair shake. In fact, Tro Kalajian talked me into writing a paper that basically said, you know, foul, you penalized the low carb group in the keto group inappropriately. And they wrote a letter in response that basically said, yeah, we did. But they didn't admit it, but anyway, clinically, it seems that this will work whether you have insulin resistance or not. You may have to be just really super strict the more insulin resistant you are. Yep. And so if you're, so I'm thinking, so 9 months, 20 pounds, let's say there's another 100 pounds to lose. You want to go, like you're starting over, get super strict. And we did a study that we never published because it was so few people and I was just busy with all other kinds of things, where a couple of people were knocked out of ketosis for 2 weeks after one meal of carbs. So that
if you hear that, right? That's a big deal. Right? Well, and that doesn't happen to everybody. Remember, for every physiological process, there is a normal distribution curve. Some people would be knocked out of ketosis for literally 30 minutes if they ate a bad meal. Other people, if they're very insulin resistant or hyperinsulinemic, that could knock you out of ketosis for multiple days or even up to 2 weeks. And they've got research that they didn't publish that showed that for some people, it's 2 weeks that they're knocked out of ketosis. And I think the fact, I'm so glad you got your doctor to check a fasting insulin, because I think what that reveals to us is that you're, even though you're eating ketovore, or you think you are, you're still hyperinsulinemic. And that is definitely slowing down your body's ability to metabolize and get rid of fat. And so if you're willing, Jillian, the answer for you, carnivore, baby, beef, butter, bacon, and eggs, that's what's going to lower your fasting insulin down, hopefully under 15, hopefully under 10, but definitely it's going to get it under 15. And you're going to notice that the weight loss, which by what, by which you mean fat loss, is going to pick up, while still you're going to be eating so much protein that you're going to maintain the vast majority of your muscle mass and definitely keep your bone strength as well. Do you agree with that, doctor?
Absolutely. Yeah. I wonder, even when I troubleshoot like this, I might even bring up the idea that you might measure ketones. I don't know if you use that.
Yeah. And I think for some people that's very beneficial. I agree. But then some people, they're just like, tell me what to eat and I'll do it. And they, that is their style. And that's, they don't, right. They're like, I'm not going to, I'll lose that meter in a week. That's me. I would lose it. And so they just like, give me a list and I'll do that. But some people need that feedback from a ketone monitor or a glucometer or a CGM. And I don't think that's bad in any way. Just the difference in personalities, difference in styles of living your life. But if somebody needs that, I'm wholeheartedly for that.
That study we did actually measured breath, blood, and urine ketones all at the same time.
And that's I love that you said that. Tell us, how concordant are those three in that small study that you did? Because you hear very commonly people say, oh, don't check your urinary ketones. They're just terribly inaccurate. And I know that they're definitely not as accurate as serum or acetone on the breath. But what did you find in your, when you actually did a study, what did you find?
Well, we had five people, so it's a small sample, but they hung together pretty well, so that the urine and the blood were close. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but so we kind of think of the blood as the gold standard. And so, but the urine was good. I mean, measuring urine ketones goes way back to the Dr. Atkins days. Yeah. And even the breath wasn't bad, although other things can interfere with the breath. Interestingly, the study lead who helped me do that has developed a breath meter, and you can't get it retail yet, but basically what she's doing is going to companies and saying, here, use this meter, the breath meter, so you don't have to prick your finger or mess with the urine. And then there's this little list of foods. Well, it's my list of foods, because she came to my clinic and took it. Yeah. So basically, it's not the meter that makes it work, but she's always coupling the meter with the list. It's going really well. And hopefully we'll see this product come out for the naysayers, for the people who need to see a number or to have the daily feedback. I understand that. I get that. But I'm like you, I don't have people measure urine or blood or breath ketones unless I'm troubleshooting. Like in this case, you might.
I agree. Wes Lynn says, how often do you see triglycerides go up on a carnivore diet? I'm 9 pounds away from goal weight. Well done, Wes Lynn, and probably a lean mass hyper responder. Let's take the first question first, and then we'll talk about how lean mass hyper responder, actually, you wouldn't see that.
Yeah. You know, there are these things called SNPs, meaning you have a genetic difference that might have you have a certain metabolism. I think it's maybe 1 in 100. Yeah. It's not very common.
Very rare.
This ownyourlabs.com that Dave Feldman and Siobhan Huggins have put together, you can actually get your labs done. And last I heard, they have a couple thousand people involved. And I hope we'll be able to show that normal distribution, or maybe it's skewed. I don't know. What do triglycerides look like on people who don't eat carbs you know, we know there are going to be ketones in the blood for a lot of people. We know that the HDL is going to be a little high, and maybe the LDL will be a little high, but I bet it'll have a percentage of folks who have high triglyceride or relative. And then that, my next question is how high? So that if it's 1,000, 500, I'm going to be agitated and want to do something about it.
Yep.
But if it's 100-ish, 200, I'm not going to be too worked up about it if the other parameters look good.
Yeah, exactly. In my experience with for somebody like Wes Lynn, my first question is typically, well, what did your triglycerides used to be? And because of the way she worded her question, you would assume she'd had that checked before, but then very often they're like, oh, I don't think anybody's ever checked them before. It's like, well, there's no telling what they probably were 1,000 before, and now they're 300. That's a huge improvement. The second thing is triglycerides are one of the things that it matters if you're fasting or not. And doc, are you aware that especially young doctors, but many doctors tell their patients, oh, you don't have to fast for blood work. That's useless. There's no point doing that. But triglycerides and glucose are absolutely affected if you haven't fasted for 12 to 14 hours. So somebody who ate 4 hours ago, depending on what you ate, your triglycerides and your glucose are going to be maybe double of what your actual fasted number would be, but their doctor told them it was fine. They didn't have to fast.
Yeah. You know, we've witnessed a sort of, trimming down. I was going to say dumbing down, but cost effective.
You can say that on this channel, doctor.
Is it okay? what's the least we can spend and still get almost the same? That's really kind of gone through modern medicine, at least in the U.S. And so you're getting shortcuts here and there, and no one ever does a glucose tolerance test anymore. And you have to pay out of pocket at other clinics if you want that generally. So I think now I forget my point, but the triglyceride is a metabolic transporter, fuel, and you want triglycerides, although I've seen them down to, 30 in some people who are apparently not using that LDL molecule for fat transport, so that you're, that's where you see the triglyceride in the blood. It's when you get triglyceride on that LDL, then they call it a VLDL. It's yep. The same molecule. But, and I had to kind of work that out by doing a clay model for myself of all of these different cholesterol particles. And, I don't worry so much about the cholesterol metabolism. I worry about the glucose and insulin, triglyceride and HDL in the blood. So those are the things to focus on in the blood. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that what Dr. Westman just said speaks to the age difference between he and I. He used a clay model and I just used the internet. I'm just messing with you. But then the last point was, could I be a lean mass hyper responder? And so the diagnostic criteria for a lean mass hyper responder, which most of us in the ketogenic community think is an actual thing. There's at least two research studies going on right now about that. Dave Fellman is in charge of the one that's probably, if his research project comes out with a true bill, it's going to upend lipidology and cardiology. I don't even know what those guys are going to do with that. But a lean mass hyper responder would have a very high total cholesterol, a very high LDL cholesterol, and a very high HDL cholesterol, but a very low triglycerides. So you're almost certainly not a lean mass hyper responder. Judy Tucker is a member of our tribe, and she wanted to say hi to you, Dr. Westman. She was on the cover of Women's World with you.
Yes.
That's awesome. Shirley Pugh says, question, can we track de-inflammation or the improving of inflammation as time goes on? How would we track that?
Well, so I practice in a university private practice within insurance payments for things, and my patients get upset if they have to pay for anything. So I don't do a lot of inflammatory marker testing, but you can measure some of these things. If you wanted to look at C-reactive protein or other inflammatory markers, even, you know, Steve Finney, you know, E.F. Hutton said, Steve Finney has been talking about the white blood count for ages. In fact, I remember it was when I first met him in the early 2000s, this low carb diet lowers the white blood count, and that's a marker of inflammation. And yep. I'd like, Steve, that's just so non-specific. You know, it's yep. meaning it could be related to your, you know, the virus you had and all these different things. But sure enough, in these studies that have been done, that white blood count is a sign of inflammation is generally lower. Not so low that you don't have the ability to fight inflammation. And that's an important point. You need some inflammation.
Yes.
And it's called constitutive inflammation, meaning if you have a cut, that inflammatory process will help you heal that cut. I remember, it was low carb. It was a low carb meeting, Doug Reynolds, so the Symposium for Metabolic Health. And there was a speaker. I don't know if you know much about him. He's kind of a medical entrepreneur, Joe Mercola.
So I've heard the name.
Dr. Mercola came in and gave a talk about how you don't want to eat anything that causes inflammation. And, you know, and then he leaves the meeting. So we call this swooping and pooping, where you come in, you leave your poop, and then you leave the meeting. So the rest of the meeting, people came up to the microphone and said, well, Dr. Mercola says you don't want to eat those foods because they cause inflammation. And we're like, well, but you have to eat something. So actually, it was the avoidance of all inflammatory things so much that he basically said, well, I'm just fasting all the time.
Well, that's what you would have to do, because literally, regardless what food you eat, if you eat Lucky Charms with chocolate milk, that causes inflammation. If you eat grass-fed, grass-finished, panda-massaged ribeye, that causes inflammation. Every food you eat, your immune system in your gut is very, very active. You're going to have an inflammatory response anytime you eat to anything. That acute phase inflammation, that's good. That's normal. That's proper. You want that. That's how your immune system is monitoring what goes down your gullet. And so Dr. Westman's exactly right. Tests like the leukocyte count, white blood cells, CRP, ESR, homocysteine, there are many acute phase reactants, and they all tend to track back towards the low end of normal when you're eating a proper human diet. But they're so nonspecific. An elevated CRP could mean that you're going to die any second of a heart attack. It could mean that. It could also mean that you've got an infected pimple on your left buttock. Yeah. But it could literally mean either thing. And so, I really stubbed my toe and almost pulled my toenail off last week. Yeah, that's going to make your CRP go up. And so you can see patterns of de-inflammation by checking these markers, but they're so nonspecific that they're not really giving you concrete black and white look at the inflammation. I'd love it if we had some specific, but even a cardiac CRP, as you know, Doc, that's measuring inflammation. That they gave it that name. I think LabCorp named it that just so it sounded really important, so more doctors would order it, and maybe the insurance was to cover it, but it just checks the CRP. That's, I hope that answers that question, Shirley.
Remember, the teeth are part of the body, even though we got no training in medical school.
Well, I learned three things about teeth in medical school, doctor. They're white, hopefully. They're hard, and you chew with them. And in med school, we had a dental school at the University of Tennessee, and the medical students and dental students, there was a huge rivalry. We played flag football, and there were many broken fibulas and many broken collarbones. It was supposed to be flag, but it was pretty rough. And so a medical student had written that in a bathroom stall. Everything you need to know about teeth to become a dentist. Number one, they're white. Number two, they're hard. Number three, you chew with them. Congratulations, you're now a dentist. But there's actually more to the story than that.
Well, so the Weston Price story, the dentist who went around the world in the 1930s to look at people's teeth, it's a fabulous demonstration that without modern foods, the teeth are basically perfect, healthy, no cavities and all. But I wanted to mention that with inflammation, I remember a group presenting abstracts at meetings on how the periodontal disease can cause heart attacks. And I was, oh no, can't be, you know. But so even, you know, so be good to your teeth, good hygiene, with, you know, floss and brush regularly. And you don't want periodontal disease, because that creates inflammation, that nonspecific inflammation that can then lead to that cascade of problems on the arteries. And there was a Dr. Otto Schaefer in Canada who chronicled first the native populations got cavities and periodontal disease, and then 20 years later, they got heart disease.
Yep.
Of course, it was ignored, and can't be, because teeth aren't part of the body. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What about, let's see, I saw one here that would be a good, yes. Mary says, can electrolyte imbalances cause AFib?
Certainly. And I guess most common thing would be a hypokalemia, low potassium levels. And that's in my clinic, it's most commonly caused by diuretic medicines that are used for blood pressure. You know, it's kind of like doctors in my area don't ask people about what they eat, but they give them diagnoses and then they give them pills. And then when the pills cause a side effect, they give a pill for the side effect of the pill. And I mean, there's a small signal, I think. I don't know the occurrence. Any strong weight loss program that causes fluid shifts and electrolyte changes might cause AFib. And through the years, I can think of maybe one or two patients who it was temporarily related to changing the diet. Of course, they had all these other problems going on, and it's at such a rate. It's kind of like a kidney stone. So someone might get a kidney stone. They may have had it in there for a long time, or if it was generated, actually any weight loss program or diet change, and there are a lot of people eating regular, like American diets, getting kidney stones. So there's a rate in all diets. And I don't know that it's any higher on a low carb diet. And then gout, of course, in a medical world can happen, but you get people through the gout and then they never have gout again.
Exactly.
That AFib and electrolytes, when you're starting out, I have people watch a video of me going through a handout, and we talk about keto adaptation, how if you can take sodium salt and bouillon as a way to do it during that first week or two. Of course, if you have medications for high blood pressure, heart failure, or kidney failure, you don't want to add salt. But if you're not in a clinical population, then you want to add an electrolyte called sodium, or get one of these other sort of proprietary blends. Do you have one yet? I haven't kept up on if you.
No. I try not to. Sell products. I recommend that people use either Redmond's Relight or Elements. They both have unflavored, so that if the cephalic phase insulin response is strong in you personally, just the sweet taste in your mouth won't elevate your insulin. We know that that's a potential mechanism for many people. And I suspect that people who are more high insulin resistant or hyperinsulinemic, I suspect that they're much more sensitive to the sweet taste in their mouth. So I recommend they get the unflavored. Reed Martin took your Adapt Your Life course. And there's a link to that down in the show notes if anybody wants to actually learn from the master himself. And she listened to me and dropped her A1C from 17, which is ungodly high, down to 6.9 in 12 weeks. 3 months later, she had reversed her type 2 diabetes. It was now she just has pre-diabetes at 6.4. Excellent, excellent start, Reeves. Obviously, you're not finished yet. You still got work to do because we want that to be under 5.7. What do you feel? I want to know what you feel, Doc, when you read a comment like this. Because as healthcare providers and, practicing physicians, we know what happens to a patient with an A1C of 17, and it don't take a long damn time to happen. They're going to lose a foot. They're going to go blind. They're going to have kidney failure. They're going to have liver failure. They're going to have a heart attack. They're going to have a stroke. Something disastrous is going to happen in usually just a few months. Yeah. What's your, I want to know, you're a very, you know, soft and cuddly guy. What does this make you feel when you read a comment like this, to know that you had this impact on Reed Martin, who you've never met? You literally saved her life, is literally what you did. And I use the word literally in this case.
Well, but like you, we were trained and acculturated into the idea that doctors help people and save lives.
I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, right?
I thought that's what we were supposed to do. and then a lot of doctors get off on a tangent, but I feel good. I know it's not, it's like, it's expected now. It's not like oh my gosh, what a wonderful thing. Because, well, it would be, I guess, like if you were a surgeon and it was the 1,000th appendix you took out, you saved a life, and the doctor goes out to the waiting room, oh my God, you saved my life. They got my, I don't think people do gush about that because, well, that's what surgeons are trained to do. But I do understand that we're kind of unusual as doctors and might actually show a way that's different than other doctors. I feel good, and I feel like it's my job, and want to pass the baton and as many people as we can.
Absolutely. And you know, at Low Carb Denver, you were there. There were a lot of young healthcare providers. There are actually two family medicine residents. I don't know if you had a chance to meet them or not. It's a husband-wife team that are on fire.
Yeah.
For keto, ketovore, carnivore, like that's going to be their life as
practicing. Laura and Matt.
Yes, absolutely. I freaking love those guys. Yeah. And that's happening more and more. I have medical students reach out to me on the YouTube channel. We've got inside of our private community, we've got multiple healthcare providers at every level. Some retired, some still practicing, some in training right now. But they're all hungry for the results. They want to be the doc sitting on a YouTube live video one day, hearing that you just saved a person's life who you've never met or laid your hands on. Because that's kind of sexy, Dr. Westman, that you have that ability as a healer. Because most healers, you know, they gotta put their hands on you, and they gotta talk to you, and they gotta write you a prescription. Then maybe you get better. But you just literally saved a woman's life who you've never met, and maybe you never will meet. That's kind of sexy, is it not?
When I think of sexy, I think of you, Ken, not me. So, but, you know, I guess to change the subject, I have to deflect this. Forward and introduction in the same book. I don't know if you know. It's one of my patients who I could not fix. I mean, she had eating disorders, was hospitalized at UNC, and came in asking for 100 ketone strips and just got so obsessed. And then I lost track of her. She surfaces in a book called The Dietitian's Dilemma by Michelle Hearn. I'm like, yep. Rebecca, I know Rebecca. And so I reach out to Rebecca. She's living in the Chicago area. She's married and having a baby, and total transformation. And Rebecca Farmer. And I'm afraid, yes, I don't remember the name of her book, but you're in the beginning and I'm in the okay, you're going to find it. Fantastic. But basically, my Taylor journey, that's it.
That's so Rebecca, it right there. Guess who wrote the foreword for this book, Doc?
You did. Well, I know. So, and it's interesting because you say in there that you met her when she was better. And I say in there that I knew her when she was ill.
Yeah.
It's a transformational story using super low carb carnivore approach like Michelle did. Yep. Anyway, I'm glad you're, did you see that I was in there too?
Yeah, I did. I saw that. Yeah. I wasn't going to bring that up, but if you guys know anyone who has been diagnosed with an eating disorder, and I use that term, for a specific reason, not that they have an eating disorder, but they've been diagnosed with an eating disorder, you need to buy them a copy of this book. Okay. This book is powerful. She was misdiagnosed with an eating disorder because she has a very sensitive gut. She needs to be a carnivore. She's on that normal distribution curve where she needs to eat nothing but meat or meat and eggs. And that's her best health. But when she was eating all the processed carbs and all of the fiber, her stomach hurt constantly 24/7. And she learned as a young girl to associate, oh, if I eat, my tummy hurts, so I'm just not going to eat. Well, that was also, she was coming of age right when the eating disorder diagnosis was becoming very popular. And so she just got stuffed into that funnel, even though she should never have been put there. And it literally makes you want to cry thinking about it as a healthcare provider. Like, her life was literal hell for a decade, misdiagnosed as an eating disorder. And what she really was a carnivore that was being, you know, she was basically a cat being fed a sheep's diet. And that's, of course, your tummy's going to hurt if you're not made to eat that diet. And so if you know anyone who's been diagnosed with an eating disorder, My Taylor Journey, please get them a copy of that book. Lisa says, is there any policy shift, RE keto carnivore at the American Diabetic Association?
Well, there's a paper that's been out several years that supports the use of low carb diets, even says that the low carb diet is best to reduce blood sugars. Dr. Yancey, Will Yancey here at Duke with me, is an author on that. And yet, you know, there's no press release about it. So, you know, it really is like the association to keep you diabetic. Eat your carbs.
You know, I hate to say that, but no, you're kind of right, because there is a low carb option now in their handbook, but it's on page 214.
Yeah.
In the fine print. But you would think that literally they would hold a press conference and say, hey, guys, low carb, low carb, low carb.
Yeah, but look who's funding them.
Oh, does that matter? Oh, you already touched on that earlier, didn't you? Yeah, that does matter.
So drug companies have a role, no question. But bring all that about diabetes together, you don't want to go on a medicine that lowers the blood sugar at the expense of gaining weight.
That's so right.
Insulin is you don't want to go on the needle. In fact, there was a 80-ish-year-old woman in the clinic this last week and was trying to get, why did you do this? I've seen her for about 10 years now. Why did you do this? She said, my mom had sugar. And when she took that needle, everything went downhill. And, you know, I remember as a young doctor, I said, well, that's crazy. The diabetes just got worse. And, you know, no, now if you're on a medicine that causes you to gain more weight, and weight is the problem that's causing the insulin resistance in the first place, you're always going to have diabetes. And those doctors are right. You're always going to have diabetes, but they're, I think, unwittingly causing it. I can't imagine that the endocrinologist thinks they're perpetuating the diabetes by giving insulin, but they are.
But do you realize the cognitive dissonance that has to be involved in that? And you also realize, because you had an epiphany as a young doctor, just like I did, shit, I'm doing this all wrong. I literally, there's this whole huge subsection of physiology that I either didn't learn in med school or just immediately forgot it. And can you imagine a very successful endocrinologist that's been prescribing insulin in all the varied forms, and glipizide and glyburide and glimepiride and all the other type 2 diabetes medications that work by giving you hyperinsulinemia, which you probably already have anyway, right, thereby dooming you to become obese or even severely obese? Can you imagine when it hits them, when it dawns on them, dude, you've been doing this to your patients for how many years? You've been causing them to be obese.
There'll be some cognitive protective mechanism, I'm sure, that comes into play. I mean, there was a caricaturist in the 1850s or so who lampooned all the different professions. He lampooned lawyers and lampooned doctors. And there was one in this book, a lithograph on doctors, and it's, you know, a nurse going, sorry, doctor, but the patient died. And the doctor says, well, he didn't take my medicine. And she says, yes, he did. Well, then he took too much. No, he didn't. Then he took too little. You know, so there, we have ways of protecting our egos from, we caused all of this to happen.
But I guess I'm odd maybe, but I immediately realized, it just dawned on me like somebody hit me in the head with a wrench. You've been hurting people with the dietary advice you've been giving. You've literally been harming people in direct contradiction to the oath that you took and meant. Good newcomer question. Kel wants to know, what are the good fats, Dr. Westman? What fats do you recommend, and what fats would you say, yeah, minimize those fats or avoid those fats?
Well, I think any natural fat is fine. So if you eat meat, poultry, fish, and shellfish, and eggs from that is real food, you're going to be getting great fats. So I don't worry about saturated fat. In fact, this fellow came in this week, how do I raise the HDL? It was in the 20s. It was super low. So, well, you need more saturated fat and eggs. He was like, well, I was told not to eat those things. Yep. So anyway, anything that comes naturally, I don't worry about. So it's the fats that come in the ultra processed foods. And this is a shift, but the world experts of nutrition have several papers, consensus papers, saying saturated fat is not a health problem. So if I'm inferring, am I worried about saturated fats? No. Trans fats are not found to any great degree in natural foods, and they're the ones that are thought of as the bad ones. And it's interesting to see some nutrition experts sort of pivoted from, okay, we're not going to talk about saturated fats, so we're going to talk trans fats now.
Yep, yep.
And it, like, it wasn't, they weren't saying saturated fats were so bad, and now, well, it's kind of fading away, that saturated fat thing.
It is.
Unless you're an organization based on the belief that saturated fat is the problem, and that's the American Heart Association.
Yeah.
So they will never.
I think they've definitely stepped back and saying, eating cholesterol, high cholesterol foods in your diet is meaningless with regard to heart disease risk. They've said that formally in their last document update. And they now, I'm pretty sure, they no longer give an upper limit of intake for saturated fat anymore. They still use the vague language of, you probably want to minimize it, but they don't say, do not eat more than this amount of saturated fat a day. So Lisa's in it. She's a member of our tribe, and she is a dentist. And she says, true story, physicians know nothing about teeth. And she's absolutely right. She is absolutely right. And the only thing I remember about teeth from medical school is they get in the way in gross anatomy lab when you're trying to look at the tonsils and look at other structures in the back of the mouth.
Or,
and the
throat. Or when you're intubating.
Or at 100%, yes, yeah. When you're intubating in the emergency department. Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Let me find one more good question, doctor. I really appreciate you doing this. KF says that you are also amazing, Dr. Westman. Both of us changing lives. Thumbs up for a great presentation. Come on, there's got to be one more question here. Jillianne's doing this with her husband because she loves him. He's currently pre-diabetic. Don't worry, Jillianne. That'll be corrected before long. I don't see another question. Any final myth that really is a burr under your saddle, or any final keto truth that it really annoys you that the general population or doctors in general just are oblivious to this keto truth or to this keto myth?
Well, now this is going to date me, but that Dr. Atkins died of a heart attack.
Right.
No, right. He slipped on the ice in New York City, bumped his head, and bled into his brain, sadly. And I know the doctor who found him, actually, in New York City. That's Keith Berkowitz, who saw a lot of Dr. Atkins' patients in follow-up. Actually, Keith worked with Dr. Atkins. And I don't quite know what to do with these folks. It's the Physicians Committee for Irresponsible Medicine. I've known Neil Barnard for ages now, and he still kind of goes, oh, when people eat eggs and, it's just, yeah. I'm afraid that's a little irritating because it was their group that assisted the surreptitious finding of the death certificate from Dr. Atkins and got it into worldwide attention. And it set back the implementation of this probably 5 years.
Yep, you know? Absolutely. Say the name of the organization properly. I want people to know. And Neil Barnard, he's a great animal rights activist. I think he's very good at that. Yeah. But I think he's a terrible physician. He gives terrible nutrition advice. And he started an organization, and it's called what, doctor?
Well, I know. It's the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And I always make a mistake and call it irresponsible medicine because, you know, it's like the peacekeeper missile. I mean, or, you know, military intelligence. I mean, you know, these are, I think they're protesting a little, they're trying to say it a little too much.
Absolutely. And, I totally agree. Dr. Westman, thank you so much for doing this. It's been a pleasure. Every time we get together, either in person, either on the internet or IRL. Do you know what that means, Dr. Westman?
In real life.
Oh, you know. I was hoping you wouldn't know. But it's a pleasure either way, and you're doing great work, and you need to be very proud of the work that you've done and the work you're doing. You have saved the lives of thousands of people who've never met you, and in my estimation, that means you're a pretty damn good doctor, Dr. Westman. So thank you so much for being with me. Thanks a lot for doing this, and thanks to our tribe. If you'd like to have access to future private live Q&As with some of the preeminent, authorities in the world about a proper human diet, consider becoming a member of our private community. There's a link in the show notes. Thanks so much, Doc. Have a great day. I'm sorry I made you miss the last little bit of the football game.
That's okay. Thank you, Ken.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.